The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Amy Rose, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay, alcoholics and practice. I apologize, I'm trying to find. Minute speaker is Morgan D.
Hello, Morgan Douglas, alcoholic. Thank you, Mary, for asking me to. Yes, I see you, Sean. I want to thank. Here, let's just do this later. There we go. Let's see. Got it. Okay. I'm just fixing. I'm still working up here, folks. Still working up here. Thank you, Mary, for asking me to do 10 minutes talk. It was great because I was so busy working tonight that I didn't have time to think about myself. And just catching my breath here. It's been a crazy year, past year and a half, with Zoom and everything. And, I'm grateful for the opportunity to be a service. You know, I learned very new when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's all about being a service. The magic is getting out of self and being selfless and not self-centered anymore, because I was very self-centered when I was out there drinking and using and doing those things. So, this last year has given me, afforded me the opportunity to, kind of have being of service on steroids. And so I'm very grateful. I'm going to tell in a general way what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. I want to say a shout out. Hi, honey. My wife's watching on Zoom right now, so I thought I'd do that. I was, my sobriety date is May 10th, 1988, class of 88, well represented. I was 19 years, I just turned 19 years old when I got sober. And, up until that time, my life was just about, I thought I was just drinking to have fun. It was like we partied, we did other stuff. It was just, all about having fun. And, little I know that, a lot of my drinking was, based upon a lot of guilt, a lot of self-loathing. I didn't like myself. And, I always felt like, if I could just, I felt like I had resentments because, why wasn't I born, into Richie Rich's family, Why couldn't I have been super rich or, have, massive karate skills or be a superhero? Superhero was, top of my list, If I could just be a superhero, everything would be okay. And, alcohol for me just, got rid of all those fears that I had. First time I got drunk, I drank 13 shots of whiskey. BJ and Hawkeye Pierce were my idols on MASH. And, there was an episode of MASH where they, were playing checkers, with martini glasses. And every time they jumped, they took a shot. And that's what we did. Because we knew getting this drunk was supposed to do something to you. It was supposed to make you feel different. I watched enough Adam 12 and Chips to know that you can't walk a straight line. You can't touch your nose, all those things. And I knew it would do something for you. And, I love the effect that alcohol produced for me the first time I got drunk. I love the effect. Now, I was only 13 years old, so it wasn't readily available for us. We'd pimp at the local liquor stores, get where we can. It was a fun thing to do back in the early 80s. This is like 1982, 1983, was, go cruise Westwood. I grew up here in Culver City, and, that was the thing to do on a weekend night was go cruise Westwood. And, I would go up there. There's a Taco Bell right there in Westwood. And we'd pimp ourselves a half pint of 151 Bacardi, go into that Taco Bell, order a 32 ounce of Diet Coke, sip enough off just to, like, you know, be able to pour in that whole half pint. And just walk around Westwood drunk. And, you know, I just love the effect it gave. I had a lot of fear, you know, dealing with women and stuff like that. And to just, you know, maybe lose all those inhibitions. And, you know, it continued like that. And I discovered teen dance clubs and drank a lot around there. And actually just right around the corner, 321 Club was like my hangout. Yes, 321, leave it people. And, you know, that's what we did. And, you know, what happened, the downturn started when I was 16 years old. I got my car, you know, and I was gone. You know, I started using my parents' house as a motel and, you know, just staying there to sleep and rest. But, you know, during the day I was gone. And just after I turned 16, I got, you know, the best job for a pubescent 16-year-old alcoholic. I got a job working at Chippendales. And, you know, Chippendales used to be right over there on Overland Avenue. And, you know, it was great. You know, I was getting money every night from women. You know, I was working up a sweat, just like tonight, running around working up a sweat. Now, for those of you that don't know, I was just a parking attendant at Chippendales. I mean, I was only 16 years old, you know. And now I was sweating, running back and forth to get the cars and stuff. But, you know, I did a lot of damage there. I stole a lot, you know, in the parking lot. You know, I'd steal a lot from people's cars. So if anybody, you know, went to Chippendales in the mid-80s and, you know, you were missing change or sunglasses or radios from your car, come see me after the meeting. I'll make amends. And, you know, I got into, 5 minutes, perfect. I got into a little side business there in the parking lot, you know, selling narcotics. And, you know, and I became my best customer. I mean, that's the reality of it. And, you know, my life just got more morally and spiritually bankrupt. You know, I lied through school. I graduated high school at, I had skipped second grade. And so I was 17 when I graduated high school. And I had really no ambitions. My ambitions were to, like, you know, just work at Chippendales and go to Santa Monica College and take a few courses. And that was about it. You know, I never took any SATs in high school, never put in any college applications whatsoever. And, you know, what happened was my mom found out about my little business in the parking lot. And, you know, and so, I knew, like, the right things to say to get the heat off. And, you know, I said, yeah, I'll do whatever, you know, just to get the heat off. You know, half of me wanted to get the heat off. The other half was like, you know, like, yeah, I could use some help. You know, if I kept going the way I was going, I was going to die. But on the other hand, if I stopped doing what I was doing, I felt like I was going to die. I was caught, you know, in that middle and that with no hope. And so I started going to outpatient 4 nights a week. And that wasn't helping. I was still going there drunk, or I wouldn't show up at all. I can remember driving to that outpatient program. It was on Crenshaw Boulevard. And, you know, this hole would open up in my gut. And I knew, like, this isn't helping. You know, this big hole, like, this isn't helping. I just turn my car around. And they would talk about these things called the steps. You need to do these steps and go to meetings. Like, go to these meetings. And I never went. And, you know, finally, you know, after one more run, I somehow made it into that. I made it down there again for the outpatient. And they said, yeah, this isn't working. It's time for you to go to 30-day treatment. And I said, yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, I had surrendered. You know, I had walked into the treatment. I had walked in that outpatient that night and sat in the stairs and just said, you know, please help me. And I, you know, I wasn't saying it to anybody in particular. I just said it out loud. I said it inside. And that's when that guy came down and said, it's time to go to 30-day treatment. So, and that was, I went to a 30-day treatment down in Long Beach called the Pacific Health Systems. And, you know, after 7 days of detox, you know, I walked with my pajamas into their main meeting hall in the hospital there. And I'm pretty sure Pat Y was the main speaker that night. I just remember a Bob, you know, I remember a Bob and pretty sure it was Pat. And I remember two of my early sobriety because I remember specifically seeing his black Mercedes out there. I remember hearing Vince, too, at one of my meetings in early sobriety. And, you know, they would take us to meetings. And I remember it about they would ship us. Unfortunately, they would ship us to they would take us to the Seal Beach speakers meeting. And that's where I heard Clancy for the first time. And I really, you know, for the first time, identified truly with, you know, the disease of alcoholism that, you know, I didn't really have a drinking problem or a drug problem. I had a living problem. And alcohol solved, you know, that living problem for me. And I eventually, you know, made it out of Long Beach. I stayed down there for about 4 months at that detox and then in a sober living down there. And, you know, I got a sponsor. Eventually, you know, at about 3 and a half, 4 months of sobriety, the pain finally got large enough where I took the action to get a sponsor, you know, because I just wanted to do things my way still. And so I got that sponsor, you know, did an inventory, and made my way back up to the West Side. My dad was still living in Culver City. My mom was in West LA, and I went back to school. And at Santa Monica College, I ran into people like Leslie and Nathan and a few others here. And they were going to like meetings. We had meetings twice a week at Santa Monica College. And I had a friend too. His name was Jim B. And I remember going to a party one night, and sober dance in Hollywood. And there's like these cute girls there. And they said, oh, yeah, you should come to Wednesday Night Pacific Group. You like it. And so I said, okay. And so I went, and, you know, I fell in love with PG. Fell in love. Clancy was at the door that night, you know, slapped me on the back. Hi, kid. Welcome. Have a seat. And, you know, I got 1 minute. And, you know, Pacific Group has changed my life. You know, I found I became a grown-up. I finished school, went on and graduated Loyola Marymount, met my wife in AA, and, you know, we just celebrated 28 years of marriage, our 28th wedding anniversary. And, you know, she's had a lot of medical issues. We've had, you know, we had problems, you know, getting pregnant, so we adopted. And we had examples in this room of people that adopted, and we followed their lead. So if you're new, you know, welcome. I recommend getting a sponsor if you don't have one. Do the things we do around here. Just get in the middle, get on the carousel. And, you know, my philosophy was I had a sponsor. My first sponsor had 5 years sobriety. And I said, you know, if I do exactly what that guy does, I should stay sober at least 5 years. So get someone with that some time. Do what we do around here. And your life will be great, too. Thank you very much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Rachel C.
Okay. All right, here we go. Hello, everybody. My name is Rachel, and I am an alcoholic. Wow, I was not expecting this to happen. I thought you needed at least a year, so I thought I was safe for like another week. And then your lovely secretary just, I walk in and she just goes, her. And I'm like, okay. I thought they were gonna ask me to change, honestly. I thought I was wearing something a bit too scandy. So I do apologize for what I'm wearing. I was not expecting this to happen. But anyway, let's get into what it was like. So I remember from a young age being extremely selfish, egotistical. I slapped my best friend in preschool because she was in the toy kitchen and I wanted to be in the toy kitchen. And then I always felt a little different, and it was definitely confirmed when I first started drinking heavily. The reason I blacked out that night was because my friend comes up to me and goes, "Everyone thinks you're a little weird." And I'm like, how do I deal with this? How do I like feel different but feel comfortable with myself? And so I couldn't. And I turned to drinking. And that was my first blackout. I was 17 years old, and then I stopped drinking when I was 18. So I had a very short-lived drinking career, and I managed to royally screw up my life during that 1 year. So I ended up going to a residential treatment center on my 18th birthday because my parents noticed something was wrong. I was not okay. And I'm grateful for them so much for getting me in the door in AA, but I was not grateful at the time. I was incredibly mad at them that, oh, wow, that's what I look like on Zoom. Okay. I was incredibly mad that they were taking away my solution, the one thing that made me feel better. And within 6 months, I ended up going to four different places because either I didn't like the place or I got kicked out or I ran away. And my last place finally stuck. And I'm so grateful for that. But what really screwed up my life was when I ran away from a treatment center. And during that time, I got a sugar daddy, an interventionist, and then I got my interventionist arrested. So if you ever want to hear that story, find me sometime. I'm not going to share it right now. Got to keep it short. So after getting my interventionist arrested, my parents decided I needed something way stricter. So I went off to Florida. And if anyone has been to treatment in Florida, or just been to Florida in general, I think you get the idea of what it's like. And this place was super strict. We had to get up at 6 in the morning and walk laps around the building. Like, that was just one example of the random things they made us do. But it really got me in check until I decided to have sex with someone in the treatment center. And by then, I was screwing up my life so much, and I was in the place that was supposed to help fix me. And I went to the psych ward in Florida because after that, I felt like I was empty. I had no more drinking, I had no more men, and I had nothing to live for. So I tried to kill myself. And without anything in my life to fill the God-sized hole in my soul, I don't know what to do. At least I didn't before. And so then I went back to the treatment center in Florida after getting released, and I was on a mail ban. So I wasn't allowed to talk to any men in the treatment center, even the staff. And that was for the best, because this is still something I struggle with today. It's still something that I need to learn how to follow sponsored direction for. And I ended up going to the psych ward for a guy. We made a psych ward pact. We'd go together. And I went. He disappeared somewhere. And I found my surrender in that psych ward. The social worker asked me, "So how much did you drink?" And I answered honestly. And she said, "That's not normal." And for some reason, something clicked right then. And I realized, that's not a normal amount to drink, and I don't drink for normal reasons. I don't do it to have fun. That's my 5 minutes. Okay, we're gonna get sober, guys. I don't do it to have fun. I don't do it to be social. I drink alone in my room to black out into oblivion, to feel nothing. And so I had that moment of surrender, and I went to my last treatment center. This was back in California, so thank God I'm back here and not in Florida. And I struggled still in sobriety. I struggled with the God concept a lot. And I had my moment of surrender in Florida. I realized I'm powerless over alcohol and so many other things in my life. And then I went to the treatment center. I was able to work on some of the mental health components of it. And that helped a lot, but it didn't help with the God concepts. And so I got out of there, went to a sober living, and found my wonderful sponsor, Piper H. I love her so much. And we started working the steps. I had to write out what my bottom was when I started working with her, and that was rough, but I didn't even know what was ahead of me. I thought that was going to be the worst part. Now I'm on my sex inventory, and that's just psycho. And so yeah, so then we got to step 3, and I struggled so much. With step 2, I was able to just get some willingness to believe. I could believe that there was something greater than me out there, because every time I looked at the ocean or at the stars, not here, of course, but like up north Michigan where I'm from, I could, ooh, someone wooed. I could see something bigger than me, something greater than me. So I got that willingness, but turning my life over to the care of God was something I was not ready for. And I was dry. I was hardly working the steps. I didn't call my sponsor very often. I went to meetings just because I was required to, and I fell asleep at several of those Zoom meetings. And I ended up going to the psych ward yet again, 5 months into sobriety, because I couldn't handle it anymore. And in there, I had another spiritual awakening. The psych ward just does something for me. It puts everything in perspective. And I did my step 3 there. And I prayed and I meditated in the psych ward while people were yelling and fighting around me. And I was peaceful. I found something that was greater than myself, that would love me no matter what, that would protect me, that would care for me, and it's changed my life. And now I am able to have conversations with my God, whatever you want to call it, God, higher power, sky daddy. I am able to have conversations. Like, what I do is I turn my music off in the car, which is something I never used to do because I hated driving in the quiet, and I'm able to just say, hey, God, what's up? Like, please help me be of service. Oh, that's such a huge one. Please let me be of service, and I'll reach out to those newcomers, and I reach out to the old-timers and to the in-betweeners because I need all of the above. I need to hear from everyone in sobriety. And so I'm able to just sit there and have a conversation with God, which is something I never thought I would do. I remember in kindergarten, I banished the idea of God. And now here I am praying willingly. Okay, that's my 1 minute. Praying willingly and loving it. So this program has absolutely changed my life, and it's changed the person I am, and it changed the person that I want to be. So to all those newcomers, just throw yourself into it. Get in the middle of it, because when I didn't, God, my life was awful still. But now when I'm in the middle of it, I feel happy, joyous, and free. And I'm able to make these connections with everyone here, to make a connection with my higher power. And it's an amazing thing. So get in the middle, get a sponsor, and thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Bobby C.
Good evening. My name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God, the steps of sponsorship, I've been sober since 1988. I have a home group, but it's the Franklintown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet at 2044 Fairmont Avenue, right across the street from the Eastern State Penitentiary here in Philadelphia. Wednesday nights at 6:30, we have a speaker meeting. On Saturday afternoon at 5:30, we have a big meeting. And on Sunday morning at 9:30, we have a step meeting, with the last Sunday of the month being the tradition meeting. If you're ever in the neighborhood, please stop by. We'd love to have you. I understand I have 35 minutes to share in it. General way, what my life was like, what happened to me, what my life was like. I'm getting some feedback. I don't know. Are you guys all right? Okay. I haven't got a message. So I was born and raised in a very blue collar ethnic neighborhood here in Philadelphia. I have seven brothers and sisters. You know, there's eight of us in an 11 and a half year span. Both sets of my grandparents were immigrants. When my parents, they struggled, they worked hard, but to provide us with a good life here. My dad's parents lived around the corner from us. And like I said, both sets of my grandparents were immigrants. But my dad's parents lived around the corner, and that's where I had my first drink. Their basement was finished into a bar, and that's where all the family functions were held, the graduations, the christenings, things like that. My father was one of 11, my mother from a much smaller family, one of 10, so there was always a party going on. And I loved the music, and I even though I was always relegated to the card table, I couldn't wait to get older so I could participate. And that's where I had my first drink. I didn't get drunk the first time I drank, but I remember what it was. It was Ballantine beer. And Ballantine used to sponsor the Phillies. And my father would take me to Connie Mack Stadium to watch the Phillies play. And they had this old scoreboard in right center field with the Ballantine logo, like the three circles. And I was running around the basement bar, polishing off the half empties or the half fulls. It depends on your perception. And my uncles were pointing at me. Said, look at him, you know, look at Bobby. And I never felt a part of. And that was pretty tough to do. I mean, we had 10 people living in a small three-bedroom row home. but I never felt a part of, and that would be true in early recovery. Most of the kids in my neighborhood went to the local diocese in high school, but my parents, being children of immigrants, knew the only way to make it in this country was by education. So they made a great deal of sacrifice to send me to a private Jesuit high school. And most of the kids who went to this school were from affluent families from the suburbs. Just me and a couple of the dirtballs in the neighborhood went to this school. And we walked to school, and the school was in the inner city. And there's a lot of most of these kids from the suburbs, it was their first introduction to the inner city. And we terrorized those poor kids. We thought we were gangsters. We were idiots. Like, as these kids were getting dropped off by their parents in their luxury automobiles, me and the guys in the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers, you know. And we saw football pools. And if you hit, we wouldn't pay off. But they kept coming back. If you want to buy a particular substance, we would sell you a substitute substance. And they kept coming back. I mean, we went to more oregano than a pizzeria. Again, we thought we were gangsters. We were just idiots, you know. And I didn't distinguish myself at the prep, but I didn't do badly either. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by. Not making the dean's list, but I'm not failing out either, you know. And that would be the pattern for maybe the next 10 years, you know. When it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education because I had a drinking problem, and I knew I had a drinking problem, and I just didn't want to do that. But I knew that my parents, they made this sacrifice to send me to the school. It was expected I would further my education, so I couldn't stay home either. There'd be hell to catch, and I don't like to catch hell. Like to create hell, like to raise hell. Don't like to accept the consequences that come with that raising hell. So I knew I needed to get out of Dodge, but, you know, my options are limited. I'm 17. I have no money. I have no skills. What do I do? I'll join the circus. And that's what I did. And not to talk politics, I just want to set the scene. No, it's 70s. Jimmy Carter was the president. The draft just ended a couple years before that. The military was not popular at all. Actually, we still had guys up in Canada. They weren't pardoned yet. The military wasn't popular, but it's my only option. So I join. I go through all this training. I got sent overseas. And that's where my drinking really took off. Now, I never messed around with any substances. I never even smoked a joint. But I had a drinking problem. And I was overseas in the Middle East. I was there three, 4 months at most. And there was an incident in which three of my closest friends got killed. And I didn't know how to handle that. Because in my family, we don't talk about nothing. It's all surface stuff, you know. You don't let anybody know anything. It's a sign of weakness. And I now know that there was help extended to me, but I kept everyone at bay. And I would just drink, you know. On duty, I did my job. I like to think I did it well. Off duty, I was getting loaded just to numb the pain, you know. And I would exist like that for the next couple of years. I wind up coming home. My enlistment's up. I take a couple civil service exams, and I enroll in school. I go to St. Joe's. I know our first speaker, he went to Loyola, I went to St. Joe's here in Philly, and he's also class of 88, so we got something going on. Sean there, long-lost cousins who never met. So I went to St. Joe's, and it's a small school, 3,000 kids, top 15, 20 kids in the classroom. Not making a dean's list, but I'm not feeling out either. Again, just to the bare minimum effort required to get by, you know. And it was at the end of the spring semester, my freshman year, kids from the neighborhood called me up and said, Bobby, the Phillies are playing tomorrow. One of those business main specials, you know, one of those midweek, mid-afternoon game. He said, you want to go? I said, sure. I'll cut class. I mean, I'm not an active participant in class, so no one's going to miss me. So I cut class, went to the game. It's in May. It's an unusually warm day. And me and these guys in the neighborhood, we're at the top of that 700 level. The Phillies have since moved. They're playing at the Vet Stadium down in South Philly. And I'm drinking that cheap watered down beer, and the sun's beating down on me, and I'm getting kind of trashed. And I told the guys I was with, I said, you know what? I'm going to run down in the field and meet one of the players. And they kind of shrugged me off because one of the nicknames I had was Bullshit Bob. I lied about everything. I talked to you, I should have stood off once upon a time. You know, I lied about everything. You may find this hard to believe. I lied about my ethnic heritage. Now, one look at me. I'm as Irish as Paddy's pig, right? No one. There's no question that. But in my neighborhood, we had a number of social clubs based on ethnicity. And one of the clubs was the Ukrainian American Social Club, the Yuki Club. And my experience, most of these clubs really are nothing but speakeasies. So I'm in there one day, and I don't know, I wasn't questioned, wasn't carded. I just felt compelled to tell the bartender that my mother was Ukrainian. And I would come in, and he was, buy me the Yuki. Well, one night I come in with my brother Brian. And Steve says, the bartender, Bobby the Yuki. My brother's head snapped around. I said, what'd you tell this guy? I said, I don't know. I've never seen him before. And I know it sounds kind of funny, but it just shows you the lack of self-esteem in the sense of self. Like, I didn't think you would like me for who I was. So I was always constantly reinventing myself. So I go down to the field, and long story short, I jump across the fence and I run across the field. The San Diego Padres were in town. And Dave Winfield was the right fielder for the Padres. And I run out and I shake his hand and say, hey, Dave, how you doing? And he's a pretty big dude. And he's looked at me and said, brother, what are you doing out here? And from behind him, my little guard's come and said, Dave, I got to go now. So I start running towards the infield. And I want to slide into second base. I don't know why. I just thought that'd be a pretty cool thing to do. But as I was running towards the infield, there was more guards coming from the third base side. And I knew I couldn't do that. If I slid in the second, I'd get caught. So I turned around, slow trot, walked the first base, like giving myself up. And there was more guards coming. And at the last second, I deked the guys, and I ran out in the outfield. Now I'm running around like a screwball. It seems like 10 minutes, but it's probably closer to 2 or 3, right? But the place is going nuts. I'm in the best shape of my life. I just came home from overseas, you know, joking and jiving. But I got nowhere to go. The fence is 12 feet high. I'm drunk. I'm out of breath. I'm actually about to get sick. So I run out to center field. I just wait for the guards to come catch me. And they take me off the field, and I got a standing ovation from 37,000 people. It was amazing. The place was going nuts. The guards, they take me up through the right field bullpen, and Tug McGraw was in the bullpen for the Phillies, and the Tugger gives me the thumbs up. Now, I like to think he was loaded because Tug had a reputation for knocking him back, right? Now, I knew these guards were going to beat me because I made them look so stupid, and I was okay with that. Because I pictured this in my head. I said, by the time I got out of jail, I'd be back in the neighborhood. I could drink for free off the story for at least a week. Now, this be a story I'd make up, bullshit Bob. But I had those four guys in the neighborhood. I knew they had my back. And I actually pictured myself coming in the bar, having the shot glasses lined up in front of me. And just right before I was to get my beating, the Philadelphia police lieutenant showed up. He said, what's the matter with you? He said, you're drunk, you high. So no, I'm just happy to be here. Just was overseas, came home, just happy. He said, well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium. So not only did he save me from getting a beating, which I appreciated, he also saved me from getting arrested. And that was important too, because no more than 4 or 5 weeks later, one of those civil service exams kind of panned out. And I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They were hiring anybody back in. Now, I tell that story for a couple of different reasons. One, it's the only funny story I got. I wasn't a funny guy. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't a lover. I was a lying, thieving, stinking, falling down, violent drunk. And if I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused everybody I came in contact with. I was a creep in all areas of my life. Secondly, it's a true story. Those four guys in the neighborhood, two of them are now sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so glad when the first one showed up because I know you guys doubted me. But thirdly, and even more importantly, there's a lot of things about my drinking I just don't remember. I was a blackout drunk, and I didn't even know what that was. I spent almost 6 months in various VA hospitals. That's how I got introduced into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember I was talking to the doctor one day. He said, listen, did you ever have any blackouts? And I said, nope. I must have answered too quickly. He said, do you know what they are? I said, nope. Once he described them, I said, all the time. I just thought that was, you know, that was normal. Like Thursday was payday for the city. Friday, I'd wake up, there'd be like 4 crumpled 1s and 3/4 on the dresser to check this one. Where do I park? Who are you? I mean, I just thought that was normal. And guys would tell me when I would hook up with them later in the day, they would tell me about the stunts I pulled the night before. And I would retell those stories like I had memory, but I had no memory whatsoever. So let me just wrap this up real quick. I'm a drunk and not on duty. When I'm on duty, I'm squared away. leather, everything's all shiny, boots all shiny. Off duty, I'm a drunk. I was 24 years old and was involved in an incident which a 15-year-old kid lost his life. And that I use that as an excuse to crawl in a bottle for the next 3 years, and that's what I would do. I wound up getting sober when I was 27. I wound up getting promoted and transferred, and I now was drinking on the job. And I justified this because the type that I was doing, I was maintaining. I was no longer in uniform, so I thought I needed to maintain some sort of illusion. I justify my drinking. Then one night, my drinking, I was so impaired by my drinking, I was put in a position where I thought that I needed to do other substances. And I didn't. That was just an excuse, but that's when my drinking took me to the use of other substances. And out of respect to the fifth tradition, that's why I need to talk about that stuff. So please feel free to use your imagination. Let it wander. Really, let it wander. Most of the stuff I did, I took off you anyway. I'm sorry. But that's just the way it was. I mean, I was just, my life, it was pathetic. I was sitting home from work one day and I'm reading the Daily News. There's an article and a series of questions. And the questions were alcohol problems, drug problems, depression, thoughts of suicide, marital problems. I was 4 out of 5 because I was single. And I'm sure if I was married, I'd been batting 1,000. And they talk about the moment of clarity. As soon as it came, it quickly left. And I continued on drinking. I cut that article out. I stuck it in my wallet and continued on drinking. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1988. The guys we were in some trouble. We go to the bar to get our story straight. One thing led to another, just another drinking nightmare. And one of my coworkers needed to go home. I gave him a ride home. There was a kid riding towards us on a bicycle, and I thought I'd play chicken with this kid. I thought it'd be simple. There's a big stone wall on my left-hand side. I just thought it would be funny for this kid to jump the curb and grab the wall. Didn't know why I thought that'd be funny. I just thought it would. But however, unfortunately, at the last second, we turned in the same direction. I ran that kid over. As he lay bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car with my nightstick and was going to beat this kid because I thought he was going to try to milk me or the city for an insurance claim. My coworker prevented me from doing that. I took this kid off the hood of my car, threw him off to the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled his crumpled bicycle from underneath my car, threw it out off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar. I made some sort of smart out remark, and I continued on drinking. When I woke up, when I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody would help me because I was such a creep. And believe me, I'm a creep in all areas of my life, I check into a hotel with the intentions to consume. I have this alcohol. I have these other substances with me to build up the courage in my life. And 3 days later, they're knocking on the door. I guess that's all I have the money for. The booze is gone. The drugs are gone. At this point, I'm suspended from my job. So I can't shoot myself. I no longer have access to my weapon. So I walk over to the window and I open up the window and I'm going to jump out. I was on the 5th floor, and I remembered I was scared of heights. And it was pretty pathetic, And so I went in the bathroom, and I filled the bathtub up with water and had a blow dryer, and I was going to pull the blow dryer into the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. How you accidentally electrocute yourself in a bathtub, I don't know. But it I was just so out of whack, man. It's just nuts. And one thing led to another. I just got my car. I decided I would end my life in an automobile accident. I couldn't do that. And I pull over on the East River Drive, which is a winding road along the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia, right outside Boathouse Road. And I sat behind the wheel of my car and I just sobbed like a baby. And I reached into my glove box where I always had that extra gun. Gun wasn't there, but my wallet was. And inside that wallet was that article that I clipped out of Daily News. And I called that phone number up. And the woman, there was an old glass enclosed phone booth there, no cell phones at the time. I called this, dialed this number up, and this woman said, "Why don't you go over to Hahnemann Hospital? Somebody be waiting to talk to you." I drove over. They were waiting for me. They admitted me to the 10th floor psychiatric unit. Kept me there 3-4 days, got me stabilized. And then I got transferred to a VA hospital where I spent about 6 weeks in our flight deck. And I got transferred to another VA hospital. And after several weeks in our flight deck, they put me on alcohol and drug ward. And this is where I first was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. There were two speakers came in. I would later find out that they were part of the treatment facility committee. And the moment that the speaker said something about his background, I didn't like, couldn't identify with it, didn't I? Just then, like, I would immediately tune him out. Too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. No. Now I'm looking around my peers. These guys in their 30s and 40s, Christ, they may have been someone in their 50s. I'm 27. I said, man, what am I doing here? These guys had kids who hated them, wives who hated them. I never married, no children. That's not my issue. These guys had legal issues, not for me. Employment issues, not for me. I had a gold shield in my back pocket. You know, I'm looking for the differences and not the similarities. But what bothered me the most at the end of that first meeting, when everyone got in a circle and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer, if this is what your people were about, I don't want nothing to do with you, because I hated God. And there was lots of reasons I hated God, and they were all legitimate. And I said, okay. But so I wouldn't pray. But I couldn't respect your right to pray. I would kick the chair. I'd make noise. I'd let you know I was uncomfortable. I was, the night before I got discharged, a nurse came up to me. She had to be a member of Al-Anon. She was just a beautiful lady who saw through all through my BS. She said, the only way you're going to make it, you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the best piece of advice I would get. And that's where I would get my recovery. I got it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't get it at the VA hospital. They did great work, drained the oil, tightened the bolts. But I would get my recovery in AA. And I go to AA sometimes 2-3 times a day, depending when I was working. I don't drink coffee. Never drank coffee in my life, so I don't make it. It's the type of guy that I am. Cigarettes, I never smoked a cigarette in my life. I'm not emptying ashtrays. I know that's not a big deal now. 33 years ago, that was a service position. Big book meeting, step meeting, strictly by accident, I would leave it to break something more important to do. Tradition meetings, absolutely not. Rules, my line of work, we like to enforce the rules. We don't like to follow the rules for other people. But I was a meeting maker, and I was as crazy as a bedbug. I was just nuts. I did everything wrong. You could do an Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't pick up a drink. That's all. I'm not saying that's it. I'm just saying that that's just my experience. That doesn't make me good. I don't want to brag. I probably wasn't the worst AA member, but it wouldn't take long to call the roll. My second anniversary, I managed to get 2 years sobriety. 1 month after my second anniversary, I wanted to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had before, but 25 months before, I'm loaded with drugs and alcohol. Here I am, stone cold sober in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to take my life. Safe to assume my life was unmanageable. Did I say I didn't have a sponsor? You kind of figure that out. So this night I go to a meeting, and there's a guy from my neighborhood who had spent a lot of time in jail. Because we were in different lines of work, I didn't talk. We just nodded to each other. So I went out to America meeting one night, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And he said that he would. And he introduced me to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's when I got involved in the program at Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's when my life began to change. And time started happening, you know, 5 years, 10 years. And I'm getting involved in service, and I'm learning about the traditions. So I got sober young, and I'm doing the Icky Pah thing, traveling all over, you know, young people. And 15 years sober, 20 years sober. And, you know, I'm 30 years old, 40 years old, 50. I said, Christ, 50 years old. That's quite a time ago. Never married, no kids. And on my 50th birthday, I'm at the Arizona State Convention. And I'm feeling sorry for myself because I'm comparing myself to other people. You know, guys my age, parents, grandparents, you know, never married, no kids. You know? So I accepted the fact that I'll never marry. And, you know, the old adage, you want to find out God says his sense of humor, tell him your plans. Well, I got married at the age of 51, and it's the best move I made. I actually had to go to Nebraska for my wife. I burned all my bridges on the East Coast. My sponsor, Dick Martin, for many years was in Bellevue, Nebraska. He was sponsored by Clancy, so Clancy was my grand sponsor for many years. And so Libby and I met her in 2002. We had a whirlwind romance. I, like an idiot, ended it. And then we reconnected, and this coming November, November 21st, I'll be married 10 years. And I need to tell you, besides getting sober, getting married was the best thing I ever did. I love my wife. She's a great AA member. She helps me become a better AA member. And I had a lot of issues with women, and I'm not proud of this. I'm sober double digits of sobriety. And I always said consenting adults, and that was always the case. but my behavior was still selfish and creepy. And I needed, the steps were helpful, but I needed some professional help to take a look at that area, you know. But, you know, getting married and, you know, the last year and a half, what a crazy, you know, I'm no longer a cop, by the way. So I actually retired last year. I turned 60 last September. But I got involved in union politics and a number of years ago. I actually became the president of the Municipal Employees Union in the city of Philadelphia. Served a three-year term, and then I got reelected to another term. And last year, with all the stuff going on, again, not to get involved in the politics, but just with everything going on, I had turned 60. I maxed out my pension. I said, man, I don't need this, you know, and I had retired. But when you have a spouse who's 20 years younger than you, I was only retired for a week at the union. They rehired me as a consultant. So, but I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. So I'm not the most tech savvy guy. So when we shut down last March, right, the Zoom meetings, Libby comes up to me a week or two into the pandemic. So listen, you're going to go to one of them Zoom meetings? So that's not AA. 32 years, right? Contemporary investigation. About a week later, she came up to me. She said, Bobby, you going to go to one of those Zoom meetings? And I know what she was telling me in her loving way, that I was being an idiot. And I was really afraid. It was just the tech stuff I was afraid of. I got into Zoom and I Zoomed all over in Ireland, Scotland, England, Australia, all over the world. I really think that Bob and Bill were looking down. And, I mean, what an amazing tool, you know? And I know there's people who've gotten sober on Zoom. We're slowly reopening back here on the coast and in the East Coast, and it's good to get back to locking, you know, knees, bumping knees and looking people in the eyes. But listen, you get sober in a pandemic, anything's possible. So listen, I finished up with this. I got 3 minutes left. First of all, I want to make this clear. I'm not the poster boy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to invite people. So come live with me for a week. See what type of guy that I am. But you can't do that because I'm now married. But you know what? I'm not the guy I was 33 years ago. I like to think I'm not the guy I was 3 years ago. And if I am, shame on me. I make mistakes. Making mistakes doesn't get me drunk. It's justifying those mistakes or defending those mistakes. That's what leads to the arrogance. That's what leads to the drink. I'm just a regular guy from the neighborhood trying to do the right thing day to time. And most days I'm pretty good. But when those days I fall short, we have a program. You know, I don't need to beat myself up. I stand up, dust myself off, I make amends, and I move on. So if you're new, I wish you well. But I don't wish you luck because luck has nothing to do with this. You get yourself a hungry. You get yourself a sponsor. Make sure your sponsor has done the steps. If he or she has not done the steps, he or she has no business sponsoring you. How do you find out they did the steps? I know, it's a test. You ask them. And you will hear two things. You will hear yes or no. The person says yes, that's your person. And he or she takes you under their wing, and they pass on their experience, strength, and hope with you. You get your own experience. You take a sponsor underneath your wing. It's been working that way since June 10th, 1935. Why needed a dirt ball from Suffield to come here and tell you to do it any differently? It's always an honor. Listen, the PG, you guys have a fantastic reputation. I've had the privilege to speak there many times over the years. You know, I attended Clancy's service. I'm very sorry for your loss. But it's the spirit, his spirit, and the many others of the many other beloved old timers who have passed away. It's carried on in your group. And you keep on doing the thing, doing the deal. So thank you for allowing me to participate in your meeting, and that's all I got.
Hey, birthdays at this meeting. So for every 365 days of continuous sobriety, we give a cake with the appropriate number of candles on it. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If you're a regular attender of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please see me at the door before the meeting. If you're taking a cake tonight, please come to the side door over here with your sponsor. And is everybody, I think they're already here. And so line up in order of sobriety, and then someone will take you to the stage. If you are taking a cake online, you email Kimberly K. at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org by noon Wednesday deadline. Hybrid birthdays will be shown after the in-person birthdays. And now we were all going to sing happy birthday. Is it birthday to you? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear A's. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back. Okay, so now let me just switch to the birthdays here. So for our first birthday, let's turn this thing, is for 1 year for Devin.
Hi, my name is Devin, and I am an alcoholic. I would like to thank my higher power, my sponsor, and the Pacific Group and just all of AA for helping me get to a year sober.
Happy birthday, Devin. Happy birthday. Our second birthday is also for 1 year for Kelly.
Hi, Kelly Lucas, alcoholic. I would like to thank Sarah Adley, my sponsor, my sober family, my regular family, and all of you.
Happy birthday, Kelly. Our next birthday for 4 years for Adam.
Adam Alcoholic. God, Gabe, Pacific Group. Thank you.
Great job, Adam. For 4 years, also Kevin B.
Hi, Kevin, alcoholic. I'd like to thank everyone in Pacific Group and especially my sponsor, Jack.
Our next birthday is for 5 years for Alan H.
Hi, I'm Alan Hassan, alcoholic. I want to thank God. I want to thank my first sponsor, Thomas Sells, my current sponsor, Hamid M., all of my dear friends here and all the friends that I've yet to develop here. Thank you so much.
Our next birthday is for 7 years for Chris C.
Chris, alcoholic. I would like to thank God, my sponsor Dave, Clancy, the Midnight Mission, and all of you. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 11 years for Sharon St. J.
Sharon Alcoholic. I would like to thank God, my sponsor Sharon, my mother Sharon for coming, my dad, and all of you.
Our next birthday is also for 11 years for Sean C.
Good evening. My name is Sean Craighead. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank God, Clancy, class of 2010, Men's Stag, and my amazing sponsor, Thomas Sells. It's been a really tough year for everybody, and I'm glad we're all here. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 16 years for Rich B. Yeah!
Hi, I'm Rich, alcoholic. I want to thank God. I want to thank PG. I want to thank my wonderful sponsor, Danny. I want to thank all the men that call me sponsor. I also want to give a shout out to the coffee crew. Thank you.
We all want a shout out to the coffee crew. All right, 20 years for Harvey K.
Hi, Harvey Alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, my sponsor Brad, Friday Men's Stag, Class of 01, my friends PG, and all of you. Thanks.
Our next birthday is for 34 years for Vivian P.W.
Hi, I'm Vivian. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, I want to thank God, my sponsor, Pat Y., my former sponsor, Marilyn, Clancy, for all he gave us, and Alcoholics Anonymous.
Now for 37 years, Mike D.
Hi, Mike. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Bob, this group, AA, and it's great to see a lot of old friends and a bunch of new ones, too. Thanks.
Our next birthday is for a former secretary of our group, Duffy N., for 41 years.
Hi, Duffy Alcoholic. Hi there. I want to thank God and Alcoholics Anonymous and all of you. And I want to thank Johnny for the love and support that he gives me and my family and my wise sponsor, Sharon. Thank you. And my wonderful husband, Jeff. Love you all.
And our last birthday, in-person birthday tonight, is for 45 years for Paul C.
Hi, everybody. I'm Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very grateful to be here tonight, and I want to thank Johnny for presenting me that cake. He has for the past 15 years, and I've watched him the 30 years before he sponsored me. You know, I love the Pacific Group, and I love all you guys, and I want to thank my beautiful wife, Lydia, for the home that she provides for the two of us. Thank you.
And we have two Zoom birthdays. The first one is for Gabby V, and her sponsor is Denise A. Oh, there they are, okay. And the second one is for 12 years for Shuva B, and her sponsor is Linder W. We have a custom at the Pacific Group to donate $1 for each candle on your cake. So at the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide.